Ah, well, I am Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic. And I hear right now I got to take this dumb bracelet off because it's going click, 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 click. It's a beautiful dumb bracelet. It's frogs. I love frogs. But it's going to go click, click, click. But I put it on because I wanted to look pretty. And it's one of my favorite bracelets. It's never clicked like that before, though. It must be because the podium's high. So, anyway, it has nothing to do with me being alcoholic, but it's what's coming out of my mouth. I'm going to start with reading something that is, it's not conference approved, but it's a book about women, a daily reflections book about women that one of the conferences that Chuck and I went to somewhere down south, I can't remember where it was, but they had a little basket in the room, and in the basket was a daily reflections book for a woman and mine, and then one for a man in Chuck's. And I just love it. It's one of the books that I read from every day. And I wanted to read today's message to you. Strangely, it was comforting to me when I read that squirrels forget where they hide about half their nuts. And I related right away. We sometimes set unreasonable high standards for ourselves. Instead of being content with average, we think we must be perfect or don't count. The problem is that none of us can be perfect in every endeavor. To be human is to be fallible, and that's okay, even though we don't often believe it. God doesn't expect perfection. How often have we been reminded of that since joining this program? What God does expect is that we do our best and do it lovingly. Whether we are at work, at home cooking dinner for family, or at the bedside of an ailing friend or lover, we need only give the task our focused We need only give the task our focused attention and willing heart. The joy we feel as the result of our efforts will convince us that we have been as close to perfect as we need be. I will do the best I can today if I am determined to be attentive to the task at hand and loving in my attitude. And that's all I'm really hoping for right now, is that I can do the task at hand and tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like today, and do that in a loving fashion. In an honest one. So I got a couple of thank yous that I want to give. Of course, Richard and Karen. Oh, they've given up their home, their animals. Oh, I knew that. Oh, I'm a dog lover. I'm not a crazy cat lover, but they have two beautiful cats, and they leave me alone. And normally that doesn't happen. For some reason, cats know I don't like them, and they just automatically come to me. And that gorgeous little Sarah that they have, I'm not a crazy Cocker Spaniel lover, but I love her. You've sold me on Cocker Spaniels. Food, good cook. This gal's a good cook. And Richard makes wonderful cheese. I think you cook too, she said. But anyway, friends, love, all the friends that I've met here this weekend, and the love that you two have given Chuck and I in your home. Wonderful. And they shared their friends. Christina and Jennifer have been driving us around, and Christina gave me a body talk massage the other day, and oh, it felt so wonderful. And I hope nobody's offended by this, but I had a wonderful bowel movement afterwards. So if you're having a problem in that area, go to her. So that's really good. And I stepped on the scale that morning. I was 161, and today I stepped on the scale. I'm 155. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, women, but if it does, go to her. Could have something to do with I haven't been eating as much junk. But anyway, so thank you to all of them. They let me sit down with them the first night we got here, Thursday night, and make pencils. A lot of those little smiley faces on the erasers, I did that. And I love doing stuff like that. We talked. We just got to visit. You know, and I absolutely love my girl time in the fellowship. You know, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't get along real well with women. You know, you were all competition. No matter what age, what size, what color, or anything, every woman in the world was competition. you know, and I didn't get along very well with the men because you liked the competition and you were supposed to like me, you know. So I saw men as just, I didn't have a very good view of you, and I can't say some of the things that I thought about you at the podium. But so I was kind of limited in my friendships, you know, and Chuck was my soul. He was going to be everything. He was going to do it all. Make me happy, make me sad, make me glad, feed me, clothe me, whatever that had to be done. That was his job, and that's all there is to it. So today I value my girl times so much. And so having that fun making those pencils with those girls that night was a lot of fun. We talked about it. We just covered a whole area of things. You get women in recovery, you cannot believe what we share. And we laugh and we cry and we just, it's just wonderful. So I'm grateful that happened this weekend. Where's Karen? Karen with the funny spelling. took me to a meeting on Thursday night. So thank you for that ride. And her and I had a delightful conversation to the meeting and on the way home. It was another one of those girl moments. So, and for all of you for making Chuck and I feel so welcome at this conference. Just more family members. I can't believe how large my family has grown. I got a friend over there in the corner now, too. So anyway, I'm going to try and get started here. Okay, it started in August 11, 1947. That's the year I was born. And I believe I came out with an alcoholic mind. I never ever felt like I fit in the world. I didn't think I fit in the family. I always, even though I look very much like my mother, and I have all of my dad's characters, you notice I didn't say defects, but I have all of his character, and I just didn't feel like I was one of them, you know. And I felt like all my siblings were better than I was. You know, my sister was smarter. My other sister was prettier. My brother was more musical. I always could find where they were better at what I was, and somehow I didn't fit in this family, but I'm stuck here. And so then I set out to be the role of the caretaker in our home. You know, anytime anybody had a problem, I was going to fix that problem. I do relate with a lot of the Al-Anon people in here. I found a postcard when I got into Bible camp. I was raised in a Baptist home too, which is just, oh my Lord in heaven. That's a whole new story. You Catholics think you got it bad. Oh. But I'd found a postcard in my adult life of when I went to Bible camp. And on that postcard I wrote home, Hope David I'm going to make something up, but I don't remember exactly what it was. But Hope David is getting enough sleep. I hope Marlene is ironing her shirt right, and I hope Raymond isn't staying out too late. And I hope, and I'm thinking, I looked at that postcard as an adult, and I thought, what in the world is an 8-9-year-old girl writing home from a Bible camp and worrying about the family members for? But I always worried about them, even though I didn't think I was one of them. And then, when I became... I got to tell you a little bit about being raised in this Baptist home. Girls were supposed to be very proper. We were not to wear nylons. We were not to wear makeup. I have nylons on. I have makeup on. But we weren't supposed to wear them. You weren't supposed to smoke. You weren't supposed to drink. And you definitely, absolutely were not to think bad thoughts. Well, we didn't have to carry a book around because we never thought about sitting on a boy's lap. Not us Baptist gals. Well, as you heard me say earlier, I would have had a whole backpack full of them if I had heard about that rule. I would have had to go out and test that one. And I used to sneak over to my girlfriend's house and put on nylons. And I would put on a little bit of makeup, and then before I went home, I'd take them off and wash off the makeup. You know, so I was already being bad. I couldn't wait to find out why men and women were so different. You know, I was telling Joe a story earlier about we had gotten a catalog. And I was maybe about 8 years old, seven maybe. I don't know. I didn't know about life anyway, and I certainly didn't know how children were produced. Chuck thought they came from a dust ball under the bed. That's what he was told, and I had no idea where they came from. I just, you know, knew that a man and a woman had children together. And so anyway, I was looking at a Sears and Roebuck catalog, and I got to the part where it was underwear, men's underwear, and I quick closed it because I knew if I looked at it, it was bad. And then I opened it back up, and this is a true story. Little girl, I took the book, and I went, I wanted so bad to see what was underneath those undershorts that was down there. Because that's all it was ever mentioned in our family with anything to do with body parts was down there. Don't ever let anybody touch you down there. You know, so I was already excited. I didn't even know what it was all about. So I was a very sinful girl before I even knew it was sin. You know what the sin was. And at age 13, it was just about a week before my birthday, a girlfriend of mine had approached me, and she had an older sister who bought beer for just about anybody. And she's a gal who was alcoholic and died of active alcoholism or complications of it at an older age. But my girlfriend approached me, and she says, Sandy, if you want to drink this weekend for your birthday, she says, I can have Judy get us a six-pack. And I thought, I can't do that. You know, I mean, that's just against the rules. And but my mind thought, I want to try that. You know, it's kind of like the nylons and the makeup. I want to try that. So I said, okay. And we went over to her sister's apartment, and I drank my first can of beer. I thought it tasted absolutely horrible. I just couldn't stand the taste of it at all. And but I drank that first can, and I absolutely loved what it did for me. You know, and the alcoholics in the room would understand that. That it just, and I don't know, maybe some of you Al-Anons do too, that can drink a glass of wine and it makes you feel comfortable and you go the rest of the evening on that one glass of wine, which I don't understand. So, but it made me feel absolutely content with the fact that I was going to be going to a dance. And I thought, I'm going to go there and feel comfortable and might even dance. You know, and I knew how to dance. My brothers and sisters taught me how. But every time I went to a dance, if a boy approached me, I got so fearful I'd run to the bathroom or something. I just was afraid of that process, being close to a person, a male. You know, what if I found out what down there was? Anyway, and so I was fearful. And I drank that can of beer, and I says, well, I'm ready to go. I think we're going to have fun. And she said to me, she says, if you don't finish your six-pack, because we each had our own six-pack, she said, the next time that I have my sister buy booze, I'm going to share it with Christine or Sharon, and she, you know, named a few of our other friends. And immediately my mind says, oh, I guess I got to finish the six-pack. And I didn't know that then, but I know today that's the thinking of an alcoholic mind. You know, because that 14 years old, you, and that's the first time you drank, and that's the person who's going to get it for you. You don't know where you're going to get your next drink. I found many ways afterwards, you know, lots of ways that women shouldn't get their next drink. I found out how to get them. As I mentioned earlier, I got some assets that summer too that I used very well. And so anyway, and so I finished that six-pack. I threw up after the third beer, and then went into the fourth one and the fifth one, and then I don't honestly remember finishing the whole six-pack, but I must have because she let me have another one the next time. And we went to the dance, and I danced and I danced and I danced. I danced with the boys, with the girls, with the pole in the middle of the room, everything. Just had a ball. But what happened in that process is there was a couple of adults there that were chaperones, and I had gone to the bathroom, and this woman followed me in, and she said, young lady, have you been drinking? And I was in the process of throwing up in the sink. And I turned around, and I just punched her. And I'm not a violent person. I was raised in a very tough part of Superior, very poor part of town. We never had a hot water, and we never heated the water on the stove. And we didn't actually have a bathroom per se. We had a little closet that my dad put a toilet in. So I was, raised in a very poor setting, and in a poor neighborhood. So you had to know how to fight your way out of things if somebody approached you. But I normally wasn't a person who fought, who looked for a fight. But she said the wrong thing, And then as soon as I saw the blood, then I was scared. And she left and then went, two policemen came in. And, of course, alcoholics don't show fear, even though we are. And they took me by the arm and marched me out of the bathroom. As I came out, I'm waving at all my friends, waving. And I got taken to the chief of police, or to the police station. I was in an office, passed out on a couple of chairs. They called my dad. My dad came to get me, grabbed me by the hair, and pulled me up, and I threw up on the chief of police's desk. And then Dad took me home. And the next morning, I remember waking up and I could hear my parents downstairs. And I mentioned about the sounds of the alcoholic home. I could hear my parents downstairs talking. And I heard my dad say, well, this little girl learned her lesson. I don't think we're going to have to worry about that. She was sick, very sick. I don't even know how she survived this, sick girl. So we won't have to worry about it happening again. And my mother was silent. And I know today that what my mother's silence was is my mother probably was afraid that, oh no, here's another one. Because my dad, as I have mentioned, had already sobered up, hadn't been in a recovery program, but had sobered up. My oldest brother was very active into alcoholism. I didn't know it then, but I know it now. And my younger brother was out using, or not younger brother, he's older than I am, but he was the younger of the two boys. And so I think my mother just knew, and there was uncles and, my mom's brother was an alcoholic, so I think she just knew it might be happening again. And she probably hoped it didn't, and she was right. It happened again and again and again and again and again. After that, when I would go to school, my attentions were, where is the party? I would listen for that talk. Before that incident, I never did. But after that first drinking incident, I would listen for where the next party is. Who's what discussion is that happening? When is that going to go on? And anything that had to do with school and academics just went out the window. And by my sophomore year, I was living a life that I did not want to live. A lot of the girls that I had said in school that I would never hang around with were now becoming my best friends because they kind of knew where to. They knew where the parties were. They knew where the liquor was. I became familiar with the boats. Superior, on Lake Superior where we live, have a lot of boats that come in. And there also is a lot of truckers. And it's not a wise thing to go on a boat with a foreigner that can't speak English. But if you're only 16, 17 years old and that foreigner is offering you a bottle and you're an alcoholic, you go on the boat. And I thought about that after I sobered up and was in treatment. And I thought, I could have been killed. Could have been killed and thrown over the boat. Same with the truck drivers. Truck drivers are pretty friendly gentlemen. And if you knock on a window of one, there are some that are family men and carry guns and will shoot people when you knock on the windows. But there's others that will just simply let you in, and alcoholic women do things for a drink that we don't want to do. And that was one of the shameful things that I remember facing early in sobriety. And I thought, at least a prostitute goes out and sells herself, and some of them, that's the way they get their food and their water and their food and their clothing. And some of them even have to feed their children that way. An alcoholic woman just is looking for her next drink. And that is a very shame-based thing when you sober up and realize that. And especially if some of that shame came with being a married woman. I'd like to tell you that Chuck supplied me with all of my liquor. He did not. And when I would do the times where I would take only a $5 bill and say, when the $5 bill is gone, I'm done. Well, the $5 bill would be gone. And so then that's what I would revert to, my assets. And there were, I know there would be today, always men in the bar who will honor the assets. You know, you just shake your fanny and you get a drink. And married women shouldn't do that. You know, so that was another area that was extremely difficult to look at when I sobered up, because I loved that man. I loved that man. A lot of women lose love for their husbands in their alcoholism, and I never did. In fact, he was so doggone good to me that he just was too good to me. You know, he was one of those men that when I came home and I was throwing up in the toilet, he'd grab my hair and pull it back so I wouldn't get puke on it. You know, you'll hear what he thought about it later. I'll save that for him. You know, but and one time I complained that he put me to bed with dirty feet, so he would make sure my feet were clean when I went to bed. And, you know, I mean, he was just the most wonderful enabler and wonderful to the kids. He was just although the kids said he was crazy, but, he would get up and get them dressed and get them fed and get them to things that I was incapable of doing. You know, so I did not like that I became the woman that I did when I went out into the bars. So you kind of know I qualified. You know, I qualified for being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened was I have a sister who went into tried to commit suicide, went into treatment. We did a family intervention. And as part of the family process, they asked the family members not to drink. And then they also asked you to come to lectures, about the alcoholism. And then they wanted us to come to the Saturday night speakers, AA speakers. And I thought, well, I can do this for my sister. I love my sister. But I wasn't very happy about the idea of not drinking, because I thought, no, she's the alcoholic, not me. You know, and I didn't think it was fair that they were asking us non-alcoholics who know how to have a drink once in a while. That we had to not drink. But again, I loved my sister, so I thought I'd do it. And I went home and told Chuck, and he was thrilled to death. He actually thought I was going to do it. And so I went a couple of weeks, and then it was on a Friday night, and I was bowling, and I thought, this is a bunch of bull. And no, I had not ever really, I don't remember ever, just having a drink. And that night I took a beer and I thought, okay, good, I have my beer. And I wasn't going to have another one. Well, you know what happened? I just had another one. And before you know it, after, I think it was only 2.5, 3 beers, I'm in a blackout. You know, I do not remember finishing the third beer. I just remember waking up the next morning and it was, oh, not again. You know, you promised them, you promised your sister, you know, I mean, all that, those feelings of horror and remorse of what a bad girl I am now again, you know, and what I thought is I thought, and I had been going to some Al-Anon meetings too, by the way. They told us we had to go to Al-Anon, and I had gone to 3 or 4 Al-Anon meetings, and I thought, I wonder if I need to go over and take that test that my sister took, and I'll go over and take their test, and of course the big book says we plan the plans and the results and everything else. And I was convinced, I'll go there, I'll take it. And they'll say, you're really making too big of a deal out of this. Keep going to your Al-Anon meetings and supporting your sister and you'll be fine. Well, what happened is I took the test, and then she called me back, the counselor called me back in the office, and she says, Sandy, you're in the chronic stages of alcoholism. And I just burst out bawling. It was not what I wanted to hear. And I really didn't believe her. I mean, chronic? Come on. You know, I still change my underwear fairly regularly. You know, I'm not an everyday drinker. You know, and I did not understand chronic. You know, I figured chronic was like somebody had mentioned earlier, the man on the park bench who is peeing his pants every day. I only didn't occasionally, you know, and I never thought of, one of my favorite things to do when I drank was drink naked, and you know, people don't go in public and take their clothes off and drink naked, you know, alcoholics do, and we think it's perfectly fine. There's a part in the big book that says common sense becomes uncommon sense. It's very uncommon sense. I would not go into a restaurant today and get a cup of coffee and take my clothes off and feel like it was okay. I just wouldn't do it. But I did when I drank, you know. And I'd do anything on a dare. Oh, I got dared one night to put on a raincoat and go dance on a bar. So I put on a raincoat and went and danced on a bar. Everybody had fun. And poor Chuck just sat in the corner going, oh, here we go, here we go. You know, but anyway, so Debbie, I went and took their test. They said I was in chronic stages of alcoholism and that I should go into treatment. And this would have been around March or April. And they said I couldn't get in till June. I thought, well, what am I going to do till June? And they said, well, maybe you could go to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't gone yet. I mean, I didn't want to go, but I went to my Al-Anon meeting that night. And while I was at the Al-Anon meeting, and they were saying the Serenity Prayer, it just hit me. I was at the wrong meeting. I needed to do what I, and give it a try. And I picked up my shoes, and I picked up my Al-Anon book, and I went down to the AA meeting, because the Al-Anon meeting was on the second floor at that time. And I sat down, and they were in the process of doing introductions, and it hadn't got to where I was sitting yet. And when it got to me, I said, my name is Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic. And just burst out bawling. And then about 2 seconds later went, what in the world did you just say in front of this room full of people? But I just knew I was in the right room. I just knew it. And I must have been, because that was my home group meeting for years and years and years up until just about 12 years ago, and I had to pick a different home group because of health reasons. We didn't have non-smoking meetings at that place at that time. But anyway, and I started going. I started going almost every night. You know, sometimes even in the daytime, I would go to meetings or I would go there and listen to the tapes to the club, the Eleanor Club. And life seemed like it was going to start to be okay. And on May 18th of 1980, Chuck and I were sitting in the backyard at the picnic table, and we were talking about what life was, what may or may not happen. You know, and I was saying, I'm going to go into treatment, and I don't know what's going to happen when I get out of there. I don't even know if I want to be with you anymore. I just didn't know. And our neighbor came over. And now, our neighbor never, very seldom ever talked to us, the neighbor on the corner. And I think she didn't like the idea that her husband used to see me up in the tree naked drinking. And you know, so I think she, you know, just didn't want anything to do with these crazy people. And she came over that day on May 18th, 1980, and she said, would you and Chuck like to taste my balloon wine? I made some balloon wine. I had never tasted balloon wine, and I looked at Chuck, and I thought, he said, don't you dare. And he looked, you know, and he looked at me. He didn't know what to say, and we both said, okay. And she came over with a glass of wine, and that's all she brought over. Well, I had gotten rid of everything in the house that had alcohol in it, including vanilla and everything in this 4 or 5 week process with going to meetings. And so I drank that glass of wine, and then we had nothing else to drink because she just went home. She didn't bring her whole bottle over, just a glass. And it was the first time that I ever really understood when people at a meeting would talk about the craving and that you just had to have more. You know, I guess before, because I always had the more, but there was no more there. And I turned to Chuck. We went in the house, and I turned to Chuck, and I says, would you please go get me a 12-pack? Now, this beautiful, wonderful enabler always did that before, but a couple of Al-Anon women had gotten a hold of him and told him he wasn't responsible for my sobriety or my drinking, and he told me no. And I just burst out bawling, and I believe he said, you have to call your sponsor. Yeah, and then I did. I called because at that time I had had this lady I'd asked to be my sponsor. And we met at the club, and I have no idea what happened that day, what she said or anything else, but that's the last drink I ever took. And then I just threw myself into more meetings and more meetings until I could get into that treatment center. And I really thought, and I hope nobody's offended by this when I say this, but I really thought that the treatment center was going to be the cure. You know, and I know today the treatment center was the awareness, and there is no cure. It's just the going on and the process that keeps, and you say process. I like your process and your house, too. You say house and out or something like that. But I love the ongoing process of this thing, you know, that there is no graduating. That was something that I always did in my life, is I'd start a project and I'd never finish it. You know, and I still am that way with knitting. I mean, Chuck has a knitting story that is just hilarious if he decides to tell you. But I've got knitting projects all over the house. And eventually I get them done. You know, but quitting high school, quitting beauty school, quitting, I just was a quitter. I would get just about to the end of something, and then it was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do when I'm done with it? And then quit it because I'm too afraid of the end result. And I'm so grateful there's no end result to this. I mean, there is. There's a lot of, you know, like, we're together for 45 years. That's, to me, is a result. But you know what I mean. It's something you don't stop. You just keep living the program over and over and over and over and just keep living it until the day you put some dirt on top of me. That's my hope. That's my prayer, is to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous that still makes coffee, still chairs a meeting, still sponsors people, and still has a sponsor. Now that's my hope for my future. So, go on to these meetings, I got a sponsor, and then the sponsor that I had left the program. She went to a religious organization over in Duluth. It wasn't a church, it was some kind of a non-denominational thing. She had about seven of us girls she sponsored, and she had said she'd like us to come with her. She says, this is a good place, this is a place that'll help you keep sober too. Well, I had all these freaky ideas of religion from when I was raised, so I wanted no part of it. And there was about three of us that stayed in AA, and then she took about four of them with her. And I just kind of watched them get miserable. You know, I mean, I'd see them, and they had the calm, the peace that I saw them have in AA, they didn't have in this new organization they were a member of. And that's not to say religion won't do it. I'm not knocking that. But this gal, Diane, who was my first sponsor, her smile was one of the main reasons why I came back. Because she was at my first meeting, and that's the only thing I remembered about that meeting is I looked over across the table, and there was Diane, and she had this beautiful, peaceful, calm smile. And I thought, my God, if I don't get anything more but that, the ability to smile like that, I will be happy. And so here she was. She walked me through, walked me through the first four or five steps, and then I had to do it again. I take that back. I did it with her after I got back out of treatment. But anyway, she took me through a lot, and then left. But I thought she's taught me enough where I don't think I need another sponsor. And I'm here to tell you, don't do that. If you lose a sponsor, if she leaves the program or you find you need another one, do it right away. I went, it was about my, probably a year and a half, maybe close to 2 years of sobriety, and miserable as could be. I was going to meetings every day, I was reading, I was talking, so I thought, to my higher power, but it really was just talking to my head. And just getting more miserable and more miserable. And Chuck and I had a spat, or somebody in the house I had a spat with, and I walked by the table, there was a dollar on it, I grabbed the dollar bill, and I thought, I'm either going to go get a Coca-Cola or I'm going to go get drunk, you know. And it was just that simple. And I started walking, and I love nature. I love Native Americans' ideas of spirituality. I sponsor a couple of gals that are Native American, and they have given me so much more than I could ever have given them. And I'm walking, and I ended up by the river in Superior. It was a Nemadji River, very muddy river. It's a river I used to visualize myself killing myself in because I'd just sink to the bottom and nobody would find me. And the rest of the world would be happy. I was by the river, and I literally came out of a blackout. I still had my dollar, and I wasn't drinking. But I was in an emotional blackout, as I know it today. And I just looked up, and I thought, God, what is it you want of me? And as clear as a bell, it was I want you to get a sponsor. You know, and I'm not saying it was a voice. It was just the answer. And I do know today that the answers will come if I just listen. You know, and I never know what those answers are going to be, and I never know what the divine intervention is going to be. I just had a divine intervention last week that was a beautiful six-month-old puppy. And it was, I had the night before, I sing with three gals. I love singing with them. One is a Jew, one is a Baptist, and then there's me. You know, and we have an absolute ball singing together. Well, we had sang the night before, and I did what I considered a terrible job, which it wasn't. I just made a couple mistakes, but being perfectionist, I was upset with myself. And the next day, I'm just in a funk, just in this stupid funk. And maybe I just should call them and tell them to find another singer. And I'm too old for this, and I don't need this worry, and I don't need this in my sobriety, blah, 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 blah. You hear the story. And Chuck and I took a walk in the woods, and I couldn't get out of that funk. I thought maybe that would do it. And all of a sudden, here comes this puppy bounding out of the woods and runs up and rubs up against my leg and is running all around us. And I went, oh, honey, how are you? Oh, you sweet thing. Where is your owner? And all of a sudden, I heard a lady in the woods go, Frida, get back here, Frida. Frida is my grandma's name. I love my grandma. And I went, oh, Frida, you came to rescue me. You know, and honest to God, I came out of it. That's, to me, is divine intervention. I don't know about you. No, I'm not saying that God said, all right, I want you to take Frida for a walk today because Sandy Lemieux is in the woods and she needs to get out of her funk. But Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools to see that whatever is there is the, I'm saying to, can't remember your name, honey, over there, but to see the wow in life. That was a wow moment. I came out of that funk instantly, and it was just wow. Thank you, God. You know, and I got lost in my story, so I don't know where I was, but wasn't that a cute story? Wow. I got another sponsor. And I had that sponsor, her name was Barb, beautiful woman, absolutely wonderful lady, and she walked me through the steps just like Diane did again. And then the same thing happened with her. She stopped going to meetings. And I learned from my first one, I immediately got another sponsor. And her name was Nancy. And Nancy did the same thing as Diane and Barb. She said, we're going to go through the steps, we're going to start reading the big book right from the beginning. Nancy was my sponsor for 14 years, so she passed away, and now I have a sponsor named Carol. And when I got Carol, Carol said, we're going to start working the steps. We're going to start at one. You know, and I think that's the beauty of this whole thing. Just recently, I had a gal who's got 33 years of sobriety ask me to be her sponsor, and I'm thinking, I only got 31 years. You know, how we do that in our heads, you know? And I always admired her. And Nancy was her sponsor when she was alive. And Sue has gone several years without a sponsor, and she saw something in me that she wanted. And what she saw is Nancy, I'm sure, you know, because we both had Nancy as a sponsor. And Sue is a gal who is very wealthy. Her husband is very high in, not really politics, but he's well-known. And I just thought, I really don't have anything in common. And I lost that common bond in my head by doing the comparing that I used to do with women. Sue and I have everything in common. Oh, my word in heaven, do we have a lot in common. You know, and I've been her sponsor for, I think it's been about a year now. And I love that part of the fellowship, the getting together and learning more from one another. And when I had asked Carol to be my sponsor, she had said to me, she says, well, I only have a couple of requirements. Of course, you have to go to meetings and not drink. I mean, that shouldn't even have to be a requirement. If you're there, you're not drinking, I would hope. And she says, well, you have to go to meetings regularly and you have to call me once a week. And I had never had that requirement from my other sponsor. They just said, call me before you take a drink. You know, and she said, I want you to call me once a week. And I know now, after having her for a few years as my sponsor, I think that was her trial for me. I don't know. I shouldn't say that. But because I only call her once a month now, and she hasn't fired me. No. But when I do, she just gets so excited. She's got a northern accent that you think I have a northern accent. She says, "Oh, Sandy, I just am so happy to hear from you." You know, and it's just even just calling and hearing her voice, I absolutely loved it. You know, and we built a beautiful relationship working the steps again. You know, she said, too, we're going to go through the steps. I was going to say something about that, and I don't remember what it was. Anyway, so I'm firmly believe in sponsorship, you know, and because I've done it the wrong way, I've done it the right way, and as every other part of the program. Very early in sobriety, I learned about respect. I had to learn about it for myself, you know, about that I need to respect me. But honestly, what it first started was for my husband and my family. And I would go to meetings and they would ask, "Oh, would you like to go to coffee with us?" And so I would go to coffee and 11:30, 12 o'clock, I'd roll in the house and Chuck would say, "Where have you been?" And I would just be so furious with him for questioning me, for crying out loud, "I'm sober. I was at a meeting. I was with other alcoholics." And I was very upset by that. And then somebody approached me and I had voiced being upset about this, and they said, "All the man wants to know is where you were. Is that such a big deal? Why don't you call him and say, I'm going to coffee?" And for some reason, the alcoholic mind, and those of you that aren't alcoholic won't understand this, we have a battle with that. We have a battle with giving people respect. That's really all it is. We think they're telling us what to do. You know, why should I have to call him? He should know that I'm with my alcoholic friends having coffee. At least I'm not doing all those other bad things I used to do. No, he needed to hear. And so I would call him and tell him, you know. And so the respect kind of started with giving it to others, and then I'd start feeling like I was a decent human being because I was treating you like a decent human being. You know, and I might have had that backwards, but that's the way it worked for me. You know, some of that selfishness started to go away and some of that ego. You know, I heard just recently it said that the meaning of ego, E-G-O, is nothing more than edging God out. You know, and as soon as I start looking at you and you don't look so good, I'm edging God out. You know, I'm not seeing the beauty in you, and I'm not seeing the beauty in life, and I'm not seeing the beauty in myself. You know, and I can do that at a drop of a hat. Let me tell you, kids, I did it last week with that singing. You know, and then the next week we sang, and I sang, and I made a mistake, and it was no big deal. So I guess I needed that horrid experience to make a mistake again. I don't know. But anyway, so I'm going to meetings. Chuck and I are starting to get along. Family's starting to get along. And life is great. Well, then we came into this stumbling block. You know, I was very active in service. Chuck was very active in service, but Chuck was a little more active than he should be. And and we had a trial in our recovery programs that really almost ended us. But what it did is it made me become aware is my relationship with God, my relationship with you, and my sobriety is far, far more important than my relationship with him. You know, and that if I keep those three things, my sobriety, my relationship with God, and my sponsor, at the priority, I can deal with what's happening in our relationship. I can deal with what's happening. And if it's supposed to be the way it's supposed to be, it will be. And I had to do a fourth and a fifth step. I don't know how I'm going to go to him and tell him what I need to tell him because I was afraid of the answer. And I went, but I talked it over with my sponsor, and the words that came to me, and she didn't give me these. This was another divine intervention. I just went to him and I says, "Hun, I love you. I do believe you love me." And I said, "But you're wearing a chain around your neck. And you've got two jewels on that chain. And the chain can only hold one. And you need to make a decision which one you're going to remove. But I have to know. I have to know." And he was furious because he, as I know now, he loved us both. And we both had good qualities. But I was ready to hear the answer. You know, and I was ready to let him go if that's the direction it went, and it didn't go that direction. I'm grateful today. And but it was another experience in sobriety that I look back on, and it was a necessary one, because he had things that he had to deal with that I think if that hadn't happened, Chuck wouldn't have dealt with them. And our marriage probably would have had another something else that would have come in there that would have, you know, interfered, because that wasn't dealt with. So, you know, sobriety, as I know it today, and being in the fellowships, is simply living life and letting the program lift you through it, carry you through it. You know, it just carries me through every situation. The deaths, I mentioned about my sister not having anything to do with me for 11 years, the first 11 years of sobriety. We were forced to come together for my dad's funeral, and we became friends. And a year later, her husband died of cancer, and she called me to help her arrange the funeral. That, to me, is beautiful. A woman who didn't want anything to do with me for 11 years, and she gives me the honor of helping her lay her husband to rest. That's the beauty of this thing. That's the wow. That's the excitement. I don't ever want to miss it. You know, life is just too beautiful to miss it, to think that bad things aren't going to happen just because I'm sober and working a program. Yeah. So a couple other things I'd like to mention, just because I think they're fun. Where'd my writing go? Here we go. I found it. There's a couple things that I've read that I always like to share, and they're not things that I've necessarily found in AA literature, but I've found in things that other people have given me. And I do think, you know, the big book says that we enlarge our spiritual life. And I have enlarged my spiritual life with a lot of other things that other people have given me through their experiences in finding their own God of their understanding. And one of the things I read in a book that my mom gave me, it was about change, and I related it to the fourth through the ninth step. It says, change can be a threat, a relief, a necessity, an inconvenience, and usually is a laborious process, usually motivated by pain, but it's worth the effort and the cost. You know, and it is that 4 through 9 are very laborious, very painful. But, man, the rewards afterwards are just, you can't measure them. Another thing I read that was really neat, I think, is about God's will. And it says that it's not important that I know what God's will is for me. It's just important that I know he will. And today I know he will. You know, he has walked me through this today. You know, my story is never always the same. Some of the things are the same, but I'm always amazed at sometimes all the time, I'm amazed at what comes out of my mouth when something comes out that usually doesn't. And I say, well, there he is. He's there. You let him at least once, Sam. There's another one that says, never put a period where God puts a comma. But if the period is there, it's for a reason. And that brings me to obviously a nonsense. And I always mention these because I love them. There are two sentences in the big book, and that's all they are. And the first one is obviously, it's on page 45. And I do that and I sound like a school teacher. On page 45. I work with school teachers, and some of them are just creeps. But others are. I'm a teacher's assistant, and we're never creeps. We're always wonderful people. I work with kids with disability, and wonderful job. They have, when my kids were teenagers, it was very often, when my son was real heavy into drugs, and I would go to work, and I would see a child that can't even feed himself and can't even toilet himself, and I would just say, Sandy, your son walks and talks and dresses himself. Don't you dare complain. You know, so those kids have saved me many, many times from sabotaging my own family. But in here it's in the We Agnostics, and talking about how hard it is to believe in a higher power at the beginning, and, you know, all the dilemma that we have with it. And that says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously, period. And that's the sentence, obviously. Well, the first time I saw that, I went, well, it might be obvious to you. But it wasn't very obvious to me. But today it is. It's obvious. I got to keep that connection. Keep it going. Keep it warm. Keep it gay. Keep it loving. You know, that relationship that I have with the God of my understanding, I have to keep it nurtured. He's not going to come down and say, all right, Sam, we got to do some nurturing. No, he's up there busy taking care of Joel. God knows. God knows he needs it. So, poor Joel. I've been able to pick on him. I love it. Where is Nonsense? I thought not. Oh, 98, yeah. Nonsense is on 98. And I like that. It, what it's talking about there is having your material needs met. You know, and a lot of us feel like, you know, if I only had the car, if I only had the woman, if I only had the house, if I only had the job, you know. And here it says, I got to find it. He clamors for this and that, claiming he cannot master alcohol unless his material needs are cared for. Period. Nonsense. Period. Don't you love it? I mean, I do. It's very, very cut and dry. Nonsense. If you think that just because the wife left you, you're not going to stay sober, or just because you got laid off from the job that you can't stay sober and can't find a God of your understanding, nonsense. It's just nonsense. I'm so glad I believe that today, that makes sense. That's common sense. So there's my period. All right. But if there's a comma there, it's needed. And there's another part of that, but I won't go to it because I'm taking too long. Perfectionism. Perfectionism, I read it once, it says, the woods and the gardens would be silent if no birds sang except those who sang perfectly. And you know, there would not be one chair in this room that would have a butt on it if only those of us who did it perfectly were here. It's never going to happen. And I'm so grateful that I can put that on myself. I know I'm not going to be perfect. I know I'm going to make mistakes. I know there's going to be times when Chuck has done something and I'm not happy. I may call him a name, but hopefully not too bad of a name. Yeah, it could happen, though. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And that I'm perfectly human, or that I'm going to go see my mother at the nursing home and she's going to say something and I'm going to be offended by it. And I might have to go home and cry. I'm human. You know, I'm human. That was the way my mother, that just was my mother's way. And it still is, even though she's 91 years old in a wheelchair. If mom is feeling bad, she's going to find somebody to direct it at. And my role in our family life was I was her scapegoat. So she still does it. And then I go home and I say to Chuck, it was one of those days. You know, but I exit. That's the part that's neat. I exit. I say, hey, love you, Mom. I'll come and see you a couple days. And then I go away and let it heal. You know, so learning. Some come to the fountain of knowledge to drink. I just came to gargle. Isn't that funny? I love it. You know, and at first that's all I did. I come here and I gargle. You know, good, got that taste out of the way. You know, but then I go back out and live life and not practice what I was supposed to be practicing, and I'd start to get the bad taste again, and then I'd come back and gargle again. You know, and I just now kind of gargle on a regular basis. Come to meetings on a regular basis, talk to my higher power on a regular basis, and call my sponsor regularly. And I don't get that bad taste so often. You know, life doesn't seem so bad. So then another one that I just read recently that I like to share, it's about making amends. And it says, you cannot plow a field by turning it over in your mind. Now, isn't that neat? And that's what I would do. I'd say, now, when I see him, I'm going to apologize. When I see her, I'm going to let her know I felt real bad. And then I'd see him, and I'd see her, and I'd go, nah, this doesn't feel like the right time. No. I can just see. She wouldn't receive it. And that mulling it over and mulling it over and mulling it over, and it never gets done. You know, you never plant a seed of friendship and love. You know, so today, I hopefully take that opportunity when it happens. You know, if I see somebody and it's happened, practice that 11th step and make that amends. And am I on the right step? I'm on, no, 10th step? 9th step. Oh, well, all of them. Yeah, 10th step, 9th and 10th. So, you know, you get up here and you lose it. But anyway, so those are some of the things that I just like to share that aren't really programmed, but they're neat. I mentioned about God. Oh, I didn't mention peace. Peace, a heart at peace gives life to a body. Isn't that neat? A heart at peace. And I have a, what am I doing here? Oh, I'll do this real quick. When I have a thing called lupus, and I go into flare-ups. And I also have a thing called psoriatic arthritis, which is arthritis of the skin. And they signal me when I'm not behaving myself, when my mind is going nuts, and if I'm just not given the time that I need to with my higher power. And they signal me. And other times, I just plain go into a flare-up. You know, and I always I used to say, oh no, I'm getting sick, you know, my arthritis is flaring up, so I think about what I do wrong, what am I doing wrong, am I not praying, am I not this way, you know, just go nuts instead of just calming myself down. And then if I was doing something wrong, it's revealed. If I wasn't, then I just take time to rest and let my body heal. You know, and I never took that equation of the body. I need to heal my body, too, and just be good to me. I was telling one of the gals this morning about, I heard an Al-Anon speaker talk about the three B's. And there's two D's and three B's. Two D's are discipline and direction. I never had them. Now I got them. And the three B's are a bubble bath, a book, and a banana split. If you don't like banana split, make chocolate or something, I don't know. But it was an Al-Anon speaker who was talking about going nuts and talking to called her sponsor and said, them, this, that. And her sponsor told her to shut up and says, I'm going to give you three B's. She goes, I want you to go pour yourself a bubble bath, get a book, make a banana split, get in the bathtub, shut up, and just let yourself rest and give your body and mind a rest. I love the three B's. Oh, girls, guys, try it. You might like it too. It calms you down. You know, especially if it's a really good book. What? Don't talk while I'm talking. Did I talk while you're talking? Actually, I did. Yes, I did. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to end with a prayer that one of the gals that I sponsor that's Native American gave me. Actually, I have a couple of them, but this one I absolutely love. Oh, no, I have to read my two poems first. Thank you, Chuck. He's nodding his head. Oh. When I was in treatment, I was so afraid. Thank you for letting me go over and for nobody walking out. When I was in treatment, I was so afraid what my kids were going to be thought about. You know, that of a mother being alcoholic, a mother being an Alcoholics Anonymous, that their teachers would think badly, the neighbors. All right, Chucky was only 12 years old, and he had never read a book on alcoholism, had never been to a meeting on Alcoholics Anonymous or an Al-Anon meeting, but he wrote this poem and had his dad bring it to me up at the treatment center. My mom has a problem of drinking, you see. It started in her early 23s. By 33, she started to see what a problem drinking was coming to be. So she went to the doctors to see if they could help and stayed at a hospital to see what life's about. She met a lot of people like you and me. It's a horrible world for a drinker, you see. They get down on themselves and you and me. I hope there's more people in this world, you see, that instead of drinking booze, they're drinking pop, milk, or tea. Yeah, isn't that beautiful? Insight. That boy lived it, and he knew it. And he wrote this poem at the exact time that I needed it. I didn't tell him how I felt, but that boy knew how I felt. Another divine intervention, another wow. I don't want to ever miss the wows. And then I have a poem that my daughter gave me when she went in the service, and this one usually makes me cry. But anyway, her and I became best of friends. We had a kind of a shaky relationship, in fact, not kind of, a very shaky relationship before I sobered up. And the treatment part, the family week, was extremely difficult on her. Real hard on her. Well, here's a poem she gave me when she left home. Best friend of mine, I love you so. You shared yourself and let me grow. A soul divine you are to me. I'll give you all I have for free. My memory of you will never be gone. How lucky a girl to have a mom. And I think I'm going to end with that because, you know, that's what you have given. You gave a wife back to a man. You gave a daughter back to a mother and father. You gave a sister back to brothers and sisters. You gave a mother back to children. You gave a neighbor back to neighbors. And you gave girlfriends back to girls. A girlfriend. You know, I have girlfriends today. And I didn't intend on that when I came to you. I honestly didn't. I just was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I wanted to be able to smile. You know, so anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.